Okay, so my name's Roberta Fisher and I'm from Oxford University. And I'm going to talk about a project I've been doing as part of my PhD. And it's a comparative study looking at the evolution of multicellularity. So I'm interested in the major transitions of evolution, but specifically for this project, I focused on the evolution of multicellularity. So there's been approximately 8 major evolutionary transitions. And in each instance, you could say formally independently replicating units have come together to form a new, more complex individual, which can then only replicate as that whole. So, for example, genes come together to form genomes, and then they only replicate as that whole genome. Cells have come together to form multicellular organisms, and you can also think of individuals coming together to form new social societies. So the problem with explaining the major evolutionary transitions is essentially one of cooperation. So why would individuals come together and cooperate as part of a new whole rather than just reproducing on their own? So to frame this another way, I'm interested in when major transitions occur and when they don't, and the factors influencing the major evolutionary transition to multicellularity. So, for people who are not familiar with the variety of multicellular life, multicellularity has evolved over 25 times, and there's some really familiar forms like, obviously, animals and flowering plants, but then there's also, maybe again, familiar to some people, cellular slime molds like Dictyostelium, which form multicellular fruiting bodies. You also have examples of freshwater green algae, which form multicellular colonies. And then again, slightly different, there's also multicellular prokaryotes, like these filaments of cyanobacteria. And these are thought to be some of the oldest multicellular organisms that exist. And then again, there's also some multicellular ciliate species which form fruiting bodies to aid in dispersal. So as you can see, there's quite a variety of different life histories that we can see. And this makes it a particularly useful system for studying the major transitions in general because of this variety of different strategies. So multicellularity is usually studied in relation to how complex the multicellular species you're looking at is. So they show a range of complexities on this continuum from the most simple multicellular organisms to the most complex. And I'm defining complexity as a syndrome of traits. So the simple multicellular organisms, like some volvocene algae, this is an example, have a low number of cell types. They actually may only have one cell type. They are also smaller in size, so this means they have a lower total number of cells in that multicellular body. And if they do have a germ and soma divide, there tends to be a low dimorphism between them, so they look quite similar to each other. And this is in contrast to the most complex multicellular organisms, like ourselves, this oak tree. We have a high number of cell types, and we tend to be bigger. We have a higher total number of cells in that multicellular body, and there's a higher degree of dimorphism between the germline and the soma, so they look quite distinct. So, we know that cell-to-cell relatedness within multicellular organisms is important for the evolution of multicellularity because, after all, multicellular organisms are essentially individuals cooperating, and so this is a social behaviour. And so if cells are highly related to each other, we expect there to be higher levels of cooperation and lower levels of conflict within that multicellular organism. Whereas if they're less related to each other, we expect there to be possibly more conflict in that system and possibly lower levels of cooperation. So it's interesting that complex multicellularity has only evolved in 5 distinct lineages, and that's the animals, the plants, the fungi, the red algae, and the brown algae. And all of these lineages have in common a life history where they go through a single cell stage. And this will lead to a high relatedness between individual cells in that multicellular body. So we know that relatedness must be important for the evolution of complex multicellularity. However, even though multicellular organisms and multicellularity itself has usually been discussed in reference to how complex multicellularity evolves, I think if we're thinking about this in a major transitions perspective, then we need to frame this slightly differently. If we're thinking about this from the perspective of the major transitions, we need to be considering whether the multicellular organism is obligately multicellular or facultatively multicellular. So going back to the definition of a major transition, it's when formerly independently replicating units, in this case cells, have come together to form a new individual, which can then only replicate as that new individual. So if we think about it, organisms, multicellular organisms, like, for example, these mixer bacteria on the left, are actually facultatively multicellular. They only come together as a multicellular fruiting body under certain conditions. And so they don't have to be part of that multicellular body in order to reproduce. Whereas, like, mice only reproduce as part of a whole mouse. So in this sense, while both of these organisms are multicellular, only one of them, the mouse, has undergone that major evolutionary transition to multicellularity. And it's often the case that organisms which are called simple and may show simple traits are also obligately multicellular, so they have undergone that major evolutionary transition. Whereas other organisms which show the same level of complexity are facultatively multicellular. So in a major transitions perspective, this is what's really important. So the importance of relatedness between individual cells for both the complexity of the multicellularity that evolves and the likelihood of it undergoing a major transition, so being obligate or being obligately multicellular, has not been formally tested before. So the aim of this study was to assess the importance of relatedness between individual cells for, firstly, the level of complexity of the multicellular organism, and then secondly, the likelihood of a major evolutionary transition to obligate multicellularity taking place. So in order to test this, you have to have a measure of cell-to-cell relatedness, and we use just group formation as a proxy for this. So this kind of goes back to what Karina was talking about different ways of you either stay together or you come together. And so multicellular species generally fall into two categories, and that's I've called these clonal group formation and non-clonal group formation. And these terms might seem a bit strange because it's not normally the terms used within the multicellular literature. But we've done this specifically so that it can be applied to different transitions, as I hope will become clear later. So clonal group formation is when you develop the multicellular body like mitotically from one or very few progenitor cells. So in this system, the relatedness between the individual cells in that multicellular body will be one. Whereas the other group is non-clonal group formation, and this is when you have independent cells in an environment coming together to form the multicellular body. And in this situation, you can see that relatedness could be anywhere between 0 and 1. So examples of species which show clonal group formation are animals, plants, fungi, most of the really familiar multicellular organisms. But species which show non-clonal group formation are, for example, the cellular slime molds. Dictyostelium aggregates, independent cells aggregate together to form the multicellular body. Also mixer bacteria do this as well. So basically what I've done is collected data on as many multicellular species as I could for traits associated with complexity. So I've looked at, for each species, recorded the number of cell types it has. I've also looked at how many cells in total that organism has in the multicellular body. And then I also looked at whether it has sterile cells. And this is important because a sterile soma is an altruistic trait. And if it has a sterile soma, I've also looked at what proportion of the total cells in the organism are sterile. So then we also record whether they are obligately multicellular or facultatively multicellular. This is important because it's whether a major transition has been undertaken. And then also whether the organism has clonal or non-clonal group formation. So this is whether there's essentially high cell-to-cell relatedness or less than high, so between 0 and 1 cell-to-cell relatedness. So I obtained data for 168 multicellular species. 149 of these had clonal group formation, and only 19 had non-clonal group formation. And then we also, for each of these species, collected as much data as we could on the taxonomy of the species so that we could incorporate this into the phylogenetic analysis. So just to give you an idea of... there's a slide missing, it doesn't matter. So let me go back. So there we produced a kind of phylogram just to show the diversity of the species that were included in this database. So we have examples of species from all three domains. So we have multicellular eukaryotes, multicellular prokaryotes, but we also have an example of multicellular archaic bacteria. And then also we have examples of clonal group formation and non-clonal group formation in lots of groups. So there's quite a spread of data. And we think that we've got quite a good representative sample of all different types of multicellularity. So the only groups which we couldn't find information for, which are commonly quoted as being multicellular, are the diatoms. And this was purely because I couldn't find any data on multicellularity in diatoms. So if anybody knows anything about that, that would be great. So firstly, we examined the effect of cell-to-cell relatedness by looking at group formation on the likelihood of the transition to obligate multicellularity occurring. So the plot here just shows raw counts of independent evolutionary transitions to multicellularity on the y-axis. So this is just counts of lineages that have multicellularity. And then in black, you have groups with obligate multicellularity, so that have made that evolutionary transition. And in gray, you have facultative groups, so these are only multicellular sometimes. And then on the x-axis, you have the ones which have non-clonal group formation and clonal group formation. So we can see that in groups that have non-clonal group formation, where relatedness between cells you'd expect to be lower, you only ever get facultative multicellularity. And this is evolved in five lineages. There's no examples of obligate species that have non-clonal group formation. Whereas species with clonal group formation, there are three examples of facultative multicellular species. There's also nine evolutions of obligate multicellularity. So this is nine major transitions to obligate multicellularity. And these have only occurred when you have clonal group formation with high relatedness between the cells. So this was all well and good, but we wanted to test this formally using the phylogenetic information we've got for each of the species. So this is just making sure that we're not treating species as independent data points. And when you do this, there's still, this is the p-value, just stands for MCMC, is Monte Carlo Markov chain, it's just the analysis we used. But it's essentially just the same as a normal p-value. So when you include all the phylogenetic information, you still see that there's a highly significant relationship between clonal group formation and obligate multicellularity. So then we looked at whether relatedness between cells influenced the level of complexity that you see in the multicellular organisms. And we did this for the four life history variables relating to complexity that I mentioned before. So firstly, this is the number of cell types, the average number of cell types for non-clonal groups and clonal groups. And you can see that organisms with clonal group formation show a significantly higher number of cell types than organisms with non-clonal group formation. And then for the probability of having sterile cells, the trend is the same. Organisms with clonal group formation with high relatedness have a higher probability of having sterile cells in the multicellular body compared to organisms with non-clonal group formation. And again, when you take into account all the phylogenetic information, these are still significant results. So hopefully, and then for the other two variables related to complexity, so this was the, when there are sterile cells, what percentage of the organism is made up of sterile cells, if that makes sense, and also the total number of cells in the multicellular body. And while you can see that these two both show the same trend, so clonal group formation leading to a higher complexity for both of these variables, these were non-significant results when you include all the phylogenetic information. And this could be simply because we had a lower N for these analyses. There's not very much data out there on the percentage of sterile cells in a multicellular body. And if there is, it tends to be on a limited number of species, so this could have caused these to be statistically non-significant. And people don't often record the total number of cells in an organism, especially for facultatively multicellular species, where they only do this for part of their life cycle. It's not something which is generally recorded. So overall, oh, it's not working. Aha. So sorry. So overall, what we've shown is that actually the only route to obligate multicellularity, i.e. a major evolutionary transition, is when you have clonal group formation. And this is when you expect the relatedness between those individual cells to be one. And this is the situation where you get the most complex traits and also obligate multicellularity. So non-clonal group formation, where you have lower relatedness between those cells, has never led to obligate multicellularity. So just to kind of conclude and to broaden this a little bit, our results are in parallel with what's been found in eusociality. And this has been touched on earlier. There's two different ways in which eusocial groups can form. And that's by aggregating, which is called the semisocial or parasocial route, or by staying at home with their parents. So that's just staying behind at the nest. And this is called the subsocial route. So you can see how these are very similar to clonal group formation being very similar to subsociality, and non-clonal group formation being similar to parasociality, semisociality, because non-clonal group formation is an aggregation, and clonal group formation is basically staying at home with your mother cell. So that's why we've used those terms, so that they apply to eusociality just as well as multicellularity. And so taking clonal group formation first, in this situation, the way your group forms has crucial implications for whether how related you are both to helpers and to your own offspring. And in this situation, say for the example of multicellularity, if you form your group clonally, you're going to be just as related to your own offspring as you would be to potential cells that you could help. And this is similar, this is exactly the same for subsocial, eusocial insects, which also have strict lifetime monogamy. They're going to be just as related on average to, say, individual ants they could help compared to their own offspring. And so when this is the case, and again, group formation is crucial for making this possible, when this is the case, conflict is actually eliminated from the system because you're equally related to, I say, units, cells or individuals you could help compared to your own offspring. So this is the only situation which has led to both obligate multicellularity and obligate eusociality. Whereas the other situation where you have non-clonal group formation or aggregation, semisociality in the eusocial insects, you're actually less related on average to individuals that you could help compared to your own offspring. And so regardless of the benefits to being multicellular or eusocial, there's still conflict in that system. And so you're never going to commit wholly to being obligately eusocial or obligately multicellular. This has only ever led to facultative systems. So overall, what we've shown is that when you eliminate conflict from the system, that's the only situation when you can make that major evolutionary transition, either to multicellularity or eusociality. So I'd like just to acknowledge some people that have helped, including my supervisor, Steve West. Thank you very much.
I'm just curious, what's an example of a clonally developing facultative multicellular organism?
So there's an example of, let me think, some cyanobacteria are clonal developers, but they actually revert to a form where they're not part of that filament after they developed.
I was wondering, if you look at the evolution of chloroplasts as a major transition, that's obviously not a clonal development of a group. So how does that fit into your kind of framework of looking at transition?
Yeah, so I guess that's the point, that the major transitions generally fit into two groups. and that's the fraternal transitions and the egalitarian transitions. And multicellularity and eusociality are both fraternal transitions. So that's when similar units are coming together. But the evolution of like symbioses, so chloroplast, mitochondria, is different units coming together. And so what still applies is that the conflict needs to be eliminated, I guess, from that system. So the interests of the cell and the interests of the chloroplast need to be the same in terms of reproduction. And I guess what I would say is that there are, I don't know much about symbioses, like, but I guess there's examples of symbioses which are facultative, i.e. the units, whatever they may be, can reproduce on their own. And so I'd say that that isn't a major evolutionary transition, whereas evolution of kind of chloroplasts and mitochondria, they are obligate. They can't do anything else other than be with each other. Does that answer your question? So that is a major evolutionary transition. It's just different from this because it's egalitarian, not fraternal. If that makes sense.
Right, thanks for a great talk. That's very interesting. Your interests are quite similar to my own. So this, that's not my point. This, it might be, I guess multi-level selection theory is probably not that popular in the West lab. I know kin selection is probably the dominant paradigm there, but yeah. I'd like to offer an alternative conception of this distinction between yeah. clonal and aggregation as routes to multicellularity.
Yeah.
Completely consistent with what you've just said, but which offers a sort of an alternative explanation.
Yeah.
One where the relatedness becomes then a result of a common cause rather than being the root cause itself.
Okay.
And that's that in clonally reproducing multicellular organisms, there are potentially two levels of selection.
Right.
The particles and the collectives, so the cells and the organisms.
Yeah.
So you can have heritable variation in fitness at both levels. It's possible for there to be group level adaptations, such as germline segregation, bottlenecks, and so on.
Yeah.
That's just not the case in the aggregation route to multicellularity.
Yeah.
So the collective does not beget other collectives. So multi-level selection type 2 can only happen in clonal development and not in development through aggregation.
Okay.
The coming together rather than the staying together. So in the one case, you've got heritable variation in reproductive success at two levels, and in the other case, you've only got it at one level. So it's perhaps not surprising that complex group level adaptations don't arise, and slime mold is pretty basic compared to trees and animals and fungi and stuff.
Yeah, I agree it's not surprising. And I guess I wasn't really surprised because I think everybody kind of has an inkling that this is the case, but it hadn't been formally done, so that's what I essentially wanted to do. I actually don't really know what you mean by multi-level selection type 2. I don't really understand what that means.
Okay, let's talk
but
about
I guess,
it
like,
offline.
Cause yeah, I know, that's great. But I guess alternative explanations are always great, and I'm sure that you can explain the patterns using lots of different ways of doing things.
Certainly.
And I know that they might actually be equivalent in terms of what
yeah.
we're actually focusing on. I just thought it was really neat that actually the group formation is kind of the crucial thing.
Sure.
And although that might not be, so the cause of why they come together to be multicellular, you know, I don't know, there's lots of different reasons why they might do that, and that's where ecology plays in. But then the group formation itself, how they do that, then I guess kind of defines how far they can go. I mean, it doesn't really answer your question, but I just,
I guess it wasn't really a question, but an observation.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I wondered, hi, thank you. I wondered what definitions you used to decide how many different cell types there were in the different organisms that you looked at.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I guess how I did this was looking through the literature quite rigorously to try and find papers where they've described this. And in most cases, people don't actually state what they mean by a cell type. Sorry, I can't see. Sorry. Hi. They don't actually state what they mean by a cell type in papers where this is done. So in that sense, I haven't looked too closely at actually what that means. I don't think that really, I mean, it's a really good point, because obviously there's going to be variation over, like, temporally cell types changing. And I think that that's going to be interesting to look at, but I haven't looked at that at all. I just took what was being said, and if multiple different things were being said, then I took an average. I just used what was out there. So,
David. So I was very interested in your characterization of the cyanobacteria, the strings of the bacteria, as an example of a multicellular organism. Is it known that whether they just come from successive cell divisions, they're clonal? And if so, what determines the length? Are they broken apart by shear forces in the ocean if they get too long? Or what's the understanding of that?
Yeah, so I actually spoke to Bettina Schirmeister, who knows loads about cyanobacteria, because, again, when these kind of things are studied, it's not the kind of thing which is actually recorded, whether they develop clonally or not.
Right.
And she confirmed for me that actually they do develop in a way where they form this filament by division.
So it's powers of two then in the actual length?
I guess, yeah. but I mean, so what I also know about them is that they do break off once they get to a certain length. There's lots of species of them that I've looked at, and some form unicellular propagules, like spores, and some they break off, so they have multicellular propagules. So I guess that's why I haven't used the unicellular bottleneck as being exactly the same as clonal group formation, because actually you can develop clonally and not have a unicellular bottleneck. Like the cyanobacteria, they have these small multicellular filaments, and they divide to produce longer filaments. So, yeah, does that answer?
Thank you.
So maybe we can just cancel my talk for Wednesday. Because I think this morning's talks and your talk have pretty much covered all I wanted to say. I sort of have one comment, and just a comment on the last exchange, and that is that I don't know of any organisms that are clonal developers that don't periodically go through a unicellular bottleneck. Mm-hmm. And in fact, cyanobacteria, the few that have been studied carefully under high levels of nutrient stress, revert to a unicellular stage.
Okay.
So why they do that, whether it's to go through a unicellular bottleneck and redistribute fitness variants from within organismal or within strand to among organismal variants, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But I don't know of many organisms that don't periodically go through some sort of unicellular bottleneck. And then I'm going to put this out there, not because I expect you to answer it, but I hope that someone can give me an answer, at least a research program for answering it, by Wednesday when I give my talk. And that is, one of the conclusions or questions that I was going to raise is, really, what's the function of a unicellular bottleneck? It's pretty clear, I think, even without before your analysis, and I think I may have even mentioned something about it in a paper I wrote a while ago, that there appears to be an association between complexity, Cassandra, excuse me for not defining it again, because we all sort of know what we mean, but it's a dirty little secret. It's a dirty little secret that I don't really know about. But one of the problems, it seems to be, is that the unicellular bottleneck also resets epigenetically the descendant cells.
Yeah.
And I've wondered whether or not the unicellular bottleneck and its association with complexity is as much about relatedness or the redistribution of fitness variants in a multi-level or a group-level selection sort of view, as it is about resetting and coordinating the epigenetic state of the cells to allow a complex multicellular organism to develop. It's a theory I have. I have no idea really how to test it until we know far more about, you know, epigenetic marking and how that occurs really during ontogeny. But I think that they're often confounded, so maybe they aren't, but it's just my impression sitting here, you know, on a Monday afternoon.
Yeah, so. I mean, I guess what I will say is that I don't know anything about epigenetics at all, but that may play a part. Like, there are maybe other things which play a role in how complex they become, but there's no doubt that the way in which the groups form is key for relatedness, and it just fits so nicely. It's so tempting. But yeah, I'm sure...
Well, then anyone more to agree with you would be, of course, the state. But yeah. I also, you know, do get worried that that mode of development also has an effect of starting with the same time. All of a sudden, basically start up with the same time and go again, go to the goal. I wonder how important that is.
Yeah.
So the bottlenecks are a more general phenomenon than just multicellularity. There's a bottleneck in the life history of mitochondrial DNA. So when a zygote starts dividing, the mitochondria don't replicate until after, I think, 12 or 13 cell divisions. And so the mitochondria are pushed through a non-unitary but small bottleneck. So the number of copies of the mitochondrial genome goes down from about 10 to the 5 to like tens. So the different lineages of cells may have variance in the concentration of deleterious mutations, and they can be selected out. So otherwise Muller's ratchet would apply because it's an asexual haploid lineage.
I was going to make a similar comment about relatedness in the sense that it may be a consequence of modes of reproduction, particularly those involving bottlenecks, as attractive as it is, relatedness once it's there, maybe the point was made. Another, though, that I would interest in your thoughts on, you seem to imply, if I take it correctly, that major evolutionary transitions are all solved by solving the problem of cooperation. I think there's a hell of a lot more that needs solving.
Yeah, yeah.
Cooperation is part.
Yeah, no, definitely. I wasn't trying to imply that.
What would you say is important, then, if it's not all about cooperation?
Well, I think at the beginning when I said, you know, it's a problem of cooperation, what I meant is the idea that units will have to be interacting. And for a major evolutionary transition to occur, I think that there's this balance between cooperation and conflict between those units. And I think that the key is that, first of all, you eliminate the conflict. And that's going to be probably at the same time that you have lots of cooperation between those units. That's all I meant by that. So I think, no, it is crucial for when a major evolutionary transition occurs, because those units are basically giving up the right to independently reproduce. So the fact they're cooperating with each other is crucial, yeah. Does that answer your question? Sorry.
Well, sort of. I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are beyond just cooperation. What does affect a major evolutionary transition, if you agree it's not just all about cooperation?
Yeah, no, so there's, I guess, the first step, say multicellularity, the first steps to being multicellular, there's going to be lots of different things which might make you be multicellular. So, you know, there's you might want to defend yourself against predators, you might want to disperse your spores. And I think that then there's a decision of how you form those groups. But the point is that what's most important is, from my point of view, what's most important is eliminating that conflict. And that can only happen down certain routes. But there's no doubt there's other factors that are involved in selecting for multicellular bodies. But the way in which you do that is important. Is that?
Thank you.
One question here. So, you presented very clearly that there are some correlations between relatedness and certain properties of the organisms. So to me, it is not really clear whether there is a direct causality relationship, as was already pointed out. Because if you consider this obligate and facultative multicellularity, then you would predict on the basis of what you propose that if you take a facultative multicellular organism and you force it to be clonal, then you would evolve obligatory multicellularity. Has this been ever observed?
I don't know. Theoretically, I see what you mean. If you can force the situation where the relatedness is high, but not that it's actually your relatedness to the things you can help is the same as your own offspring. If you can force that situation, then yeah, I guess there's no reason why it wouldn't, the conflict is gone. So I guess there's no reason why it wouldn't be able to become obligate. But I don't know if that's been done or if it could be done or, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
In the interest of clarifying some semantic issues, can you explain what you mean a little bit about a cellular unit giving it the right to reproduce?
Okay, so what I mean is, when you're, if you're a cell, you want to reproduce, and do you mean in context to whether you'd want to help or reproduce? Is that?
Well, I'm just kind of, you say when you're a cell, you want to reproduce. I mean, that seems kind of anthropomorphic. I mean, cells reproduce.
Yeah.
You know, and
Okay, so that's maybe just me speaking too casually. I mean, that cells divide. That's what they do. And the way you can form groups through division, and you can form groups through aggregating. That was the only distinction I was making. That division is crucial to forming groups that way.
So they're giving up their opportunity to reproduce more than their right?
Yeah. If I said right, that's very anthropomorphic of me. Yeah.
I just brought it up because it's been said before in the same way and during this conference.
So I wanted to just add a quick comment or a thought about this question of sort of what's, not even sure how to phrase it anymore, but let me just tell you guys a little bit about some very cool biology of clonal organisms. So some of the organisms I study, things like sea squirts and hydrozoans and sponges, are capable of fusing both with self and non-self, and they have complicated genetically based self-non-self recognition systems that mediate the specificity of those kinds of behaviors. They're super polymorphic systems. And one of the interesting things that was observed by a very eminent Japanese developmental biologist almost 40 years ago, Oka, was that if you take two clonal pieces of a colony of a sea squirt called Botrytis, which lives under actually the floating docks here in the marina, and normally if they are allowed to develop separately but at the same temperature, when they fuse back together again, there's no sign of a loss of vigor or any sort of developmental instability. If you rear one piece of the clone, a clonal fragment at a different temperature, a higher or lower temperature than the other, then they actually become developmentally desynchronized. There's a sort of cyclical behavior in these colonies. And when they fuse again, they're genetically compatible. They'll fuse. But the individual, the still genetically homogeneous individual, will fall into almost complete developmental disarray and eventually self-destruct. And it just occurred to me, you know, as this conversation was unfolding, that those are the kinds of studies, now that we go back and look at epigenetic tagging and so on and so forth, that we could actually use those kinds of systems to help understand the role of clonality and genetic identity versus I don't mean just epigenetics, but what we know is that the development of cellular complexity is not a function of changes in the genotypes of the organism. It's a function of changes in patterns of gene expression in different cell lineages, not genetically distinct cell lineages. And so I still want to make the point, I think these are experimentally tractable kinds of studies. I don't know whether we could even do that in Dictyostelium. How you can sort of developmentally disrupt the programs and then allow a clone to co-aggregate versus a group of heterogeneous individuals and see how that influences, you know, slight formation and so on and so forth. But I think they're feasible experiments.
Going back to the relation between the relatedness and the obligate multicellularity, It could be that one factor that is important here is really the need to eliminate competition between somatic cells, and it could very well be that if the different somatic cells have different genomes, then it becomes much harder to eliminate those conflicts, because the way you eliminate those conflicts is by evolving a control of gene expression that would allow you to coordinate the activities of all the cells. Now, if this goes wrong, like for example, when tumor arises, which is associated with genetic changes, then composition, then the competition is comes in and destroys the organism.
Yep.
So it could be that the causality works in this way, that unless you have very high relatedness, there's no good way to prevent the competition between the somatic cells.
Yeah, that's a great point, I guess. Yeah. Again.
Sorry, one.
I think the competition issue is an important one. I've written about it a lot, but I also think that it's relatively easy to mediate that. And in fact, during the process of syngamy, two very different genotypes, especially in outbred organisms, somehow find a way to cooperate and produce an organism, and deal with the problem of heterozygosis across perhaps genome-wide in very outbred organisms. So I think that a fair meiosis and mitosis is one mechanism that mediates that. Which came first, I don't know, but I think that's one way to look at it.
I think just one more question, because she had the longest run of questions. David.
Yeah, just real quick. So you didn't find any instances of species that are obligately multicellular and aggregate? I'm just wondering, how would that even be possible? I mean, isn't it by definition not even possible for that to happen?
Yeah, so it's kind of, I guess I can see a point that if you're going to be aggregative, then when you reproduce, you're going to be like clonally reproducing. Yeah? Is that what you mean?
Well, no, just that, if you require, if you need to be multicellular, but then you also need to aggregate to be multicellular, then there's, you're just a single cell just floating around waiting to aggregate with other cells, and then once you do, then you can divide? I guess I just don't understand how.
Yeah, so
what
I
that
guess
would look like.
It's not theoretically impossible that you could have an aggregation of cells in a multicellular body, which then unaggregate and have to aggregate again to be multicellular. I guess to reproduce. Sorry. So, but I don't think that's going to happen. It's theoretically possible. Just, I think. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.